heavenly mother crying. These children are dying at the hands of the other child. I know her heart is breaking, feel the earth is shaking, that rivers flow from the tears she cries. She cries, she cries. Rachel's weeping for her children.
Rachel's weeping.
Somehow someone's got to save them.
Save the children.
And if you say that love the answer, why don't we begin? Or will we just end?
Good evening and welcome to Heart Talk with Miss E. Today is Wednesday, May 25th. This is the last Wednesday of National Foster Care Awareness Month. And I hope that if you're not a regular listener and if you're not someone that's actively involved with the foster care community, that this will not be your last time this year. Hopefully this has just been the beginning of being aware of the plight of our young people. Over almost 500,000 here in the United States alone, 80,000 here in the state of California, and I'm not sure of the other statistics in the other states, but that number is growing. And not only is it growing, the needs are multiplying. As most of our guests here have been young people who grew up in the foster care system, who now are parents themselves, and we know that the impact of their growth in the foster care system has been very strong. And fortunately, many of those who we've interviewed here have been able to overcome the negatives of that impact and are coping. And our goal here is to help you, our listeners, to be able to, one, make a difference in the lives of the children who are coming forth, two, for healing, continued healing and growth, and wholeness for those who've, I would say, endured, but I think the word that someone said recently is that it always comes up as survived. So I am grateful to be able to be in this place to give voice to the youth of the foster care system. Our guest tonight is a young man whom actually I just heard his voice for the first time last week, but I've had the opportunity of meeting via good old Facebook, and it's already been a joy, and I'm very excited to have him as our guest tonight. Stuart Mills is a young man who grew up in the foster care system, and if you had an opportunity to read our intro for his bio, he stated that he had a pretty normal childhood. Actually, his words were decent, during the first 9 years of life, or so he thought. And it was then that a woman whom he later came to know was a social worker informed him that the family he lived with all those years were not even his quote-unquote real parents. And I put quote-unquote because I have an issue with people calling, asking my foster children if that's your real mom. I said, yeah, I'm a mom and I'm real. But anyway, we're going to talk to Stuart today about A Family of My Own, and I took that title from one of his blogs in which he talked about the growing up and the issues that he faced. And we're going to actually lean towards a somewhat of a different topic in the process, but it all pans out. So, Stuart, welcome to Heart Talk with Miss E.
Thank you, Miss E. And let me first, if I may, say hi to a couple of friends, Nikki, Kathy, Lucy, Tom, and Derek. These are all friends from Facebook, and I teased them tonight, told them there would be a pop quiz if they were listening, so there's your answer.
So, I love it. And the camaraderie that's in the group is just awesome. Let me just ask you, how did you get involved with the group? How did you become aware of it, and is it like anything that you've experienced before?
Actually, I became more aware of Foster Care Alumni of America, FCAA, through an old social worker of mine. From there, I met Derek, and then, Derek made it, you know, made us all aware that Facebook was changing their group settings and whatnot. So I just followed Derek, and then the next thing you know, I meet you know, all these wonderful former fosters, and one thing led to another. We struck up a camaraderie, I guess is the word I'm looking for.
And the other word is family, because there is a sense of family there, and I'm thankful for the members there who have accepted me, because a lot of times, not being a former foster youth myself, but being an ally, sometimes allies, you know, people want their own place, and I can understand that, but when you care, you also want to be a part, so I'm grateful for the acceptance. So let's talk a little bit about you. At 9 years of age, you were told that these people who you knew as mom and dad were not your parents. Did you ever have any glimmer that that could have been the case prior to that conversation?
No, actually, I had no sense that there was anything wrong with the family structure or the family as a whole. I was treated like theirs. You know, I got disciplined like their own, rewarded like their own, you know, and called them mom and dad.
How many other children were in the home?
Let's see. Gosh, there was David, Joyce, about maybe four at one time, two of them being their own, and the other two, you know, being me and another foster child. But from time to time, there would be, you know, foster children going in and out. We just recently, as I stated last week, just recently buried my foster father on January 15th. I found out that over the years, all in all, they had over 300 foster children come through their door.
Wow. So during that time, prior to the social worker telling you, were you aware that the other child was a foster child?
No, actually, I was not. The only thing that I knew at that time was that both of us had different last names, and I didn't think to question it. Like I said, none of us were treated differently. You know, we all had chores. We all had, like other family members, we had certain responsibilities that were required of us. So, you know, we were treated as part of the family.
Okay. And so that means something was working. There was something that they did that gave you that sense of acceptance, belonging, and security. So you didn't know anything different. How old were you when you were placed with them?
I was 2 years old when I was placed into the system. And a little side note here, after talking to mom and dad years later, they told me that the day that I walked into their house, I walked in and said, "Hi, Mom, where's Dad?" Found Dad and, you know, "Hi, Dad." So, it's great to go back to them every so often and hear this stuff that I used to do that I just don't remember. But I was 2 years old when I entered their home.
Wow. And so you don't remember in any of that?
No, unfortunately, I don't.
Okay. But that was where you belonged. So when you found this information out, I mean, it was like somebody just probably coming from out of space throwing this at you. And one of the descriptions that you said you felt betrayed, you were shocked, you were angry, all these things started going on. And did you have any conversation with the foster parents after the social worker left on that day?
I did. My mom was very upset because she asked me, you know, she could tell by my demeanor that there was something wrong. So she asked me what me and my social worker talked about. And,
she didn't even know the social worker was telling you.
But she didn't. She had no idea that the social worker was going to tell me.
Oh, my goodness.
Needless to say, she was fairly angry is a polite way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
She did, of course, I was asking all sorts of questions. She said, just wait till Dad gets home and we'll sit down and talk about it. And, of course, I didn't want to hear no parts of wait till Dad gets home. I wanted answers and I wanted them then.
Mm-hmm.
But ran away from home that day. That was the first time I ever ran away from home. I didn't go far, though. I went to the neighbor's house and hid in his barn. But, you know, I'm 9 years old. I'm thinking I'm doing something. So,
right.
But at any rate, Dad came home, and needless to say, Mom and Dad both were kind of floored and shocked that she would do this. And they did their best. I can't say enough. They really did their best to continue to show me continue to let me feel and make me feel like I was part of the family. Weeks and months would go by, and, of course, my behavior was getting worse and worse. So, Dad mentioned at one point in time, he says, have we ever treated you any differently than we treat anybody else? And I said, no. He says, have you ever heard me introduce you to anybody as not being my son? And I said, well, I've never heard you introduce me. So he marched me across the street to the neighbor's house, and, of course, I forget the neighbor's name now, but he says, have you met my son, Stuart?
Oh!
So that was, years later, hindsight's always 20/20, but years later, it still tugs at me a bit. But as far as my first foster parents go, for 7 years I stayed with them, and they gave me a lot of the, I guess you could say, moral values that I'm trying to, bring back into my present life. To respect your elders and, like I told you last night when we spoke for a little bit, I had every Sunday and Wednesday I had a drug problem. I was drug in church. So, I grew up in church.
I got to get it. Somebody didn't catch it because I was laughing. I think I may have drowned you out.
I said that every Sunday and Wednesday I had a drug problem. I was drugged to church. Every Sunday morning, every Sunday night, every Wednesday night.
Wow.
And, they're a God-fearing couple, and they did their best to bring me up in a good way. But of course,
after you were told, did you actually move from that home? Were you removed by the social worker? Did you keep running away? Or how did your move from their home occur?
Well, I guess it was about 3 months after the groundbreaking news. My behavior was very disruptive. I started cutting up in class. I was lying and cheating and stealing. And, I was just rebelling against everything. I had lost my identity.
And so that behavior was new. How did you been doing? And I'm glad you brought up school, because that's one of the areas that I want to focus on, and bringing the whole sense of academic performance, school, and home together. So had your behavior in school prior to that been, would you say, okay?
I wasn't an honor student, but I was definitely above okay.
Okay.
So, I was doing well. Maybe a couple of A's here and there, but mostly B's and C's. My behavior was, it wasn't bad. Matter of fact, I remember, now this is when it was allowed, people, so don't be blowing up the internet here. I remember my behavior got so bad one time in school that I actually got paddled in school and then turned around and got paddled at home. So for my bad behavior. So But like I say, before this this earth-shattering news, I was decent. I was a good kid. I was, you know, I was a kid that everybody wanted to know. I was, you know, pretty much accepted by everybody. But then afterwards, you know, it all changed. I changed. Everything changed. My home. I didn't know what home was anymore.
Even though the foster parents and your caregivers didn't change, all this is what was going on inside of you.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And I guess you could say.
For a minute. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I guess you could say I became, I was later labeled as emotionally disturbed, so, you know, it's not without good reason at any rate.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you know, my take on that is that we all are emotionally disturbed at some point. We got emotions, they're disturbed. Some days we're more disturbed than others, and with issues going on in our lives, you know, there's no doubt that there are things that are going on in children's lives, especially when they've gone through the foster care system and had a lot of changes, that there's a lot of disruption. And so I think, you know, just that label, emotionally disturbed, is something that is pathologized, but I think it's the norm. We all have emotions, and there are days we are quite disturbed, and sometimes the pattern continues. So how were you removed from the foster family?
My social worker found a group home in Maryland.
This is the same. Told you that this was not your biological family.
Correct. And
okay, she's so fired. And I got her name too. We're gonna Google her.
But she's actually since retired. I say she's actually since retired. So. She placed me in a group home in Baltimore, and I guess I was there for 3, maybe 4 months. And I came back to Delmar, Delaware. Now, keep in mind, my foster parents lived in Delmar, Delaware, but I was actually within the Maryland foster care system. It just so happened that, you know, Delmar and the county in Maryland that I was in are very close. There's like maybe 10 minutes difference from where I lived and the Maryland state line, so they didn't have a problem with me being out there.
Wow.
So anyway, I'm in Baltimore for about 3-4 months, and of course, every time I got on that Trailways bus for, you know, to go home or to go back to the group home after weekend visits, Mom, Dad, and I would all be in tears, and I would be swearing them down that I would be good. I don't want to go. I'll be good. I promise I'll be good. Don't send me back. And, but, you know, eventually I did come home, and I guess about maybe two weeks would go by, and something wouldn't go my way, and the next thing you know, I'm back to my rebel without a cause. And, let's see, by the time I'm 10 years old, I'm in my second group home back in Baltimore, and never to return to Del Mar again.
Wow. That story really strikes a nerve for me, because I had a similar experience with my youngest foster son going through the group homes and not coming back. So as the foster parent and the caregiver, there's a sadness. And there's also, people say, oh, you have such a big heart, and, you know, you're so kind. But I think people don't realize a lot of times what we have passion for is how we act out our anger in a positive way. And the reason I do what I do is so that a child won't have to go through that. Because if you ask me, that social worker, one, set you up she set your family up. I think it could have been handled a totally different way. And I guess my other question is, were you in any kind of counseling? Probably in the group home you did, but were you going through any counseling in the family home?
At this point in time and in this particular county, now, granted, this is, you know, the early 80s,
I was a worker in the early 80s, and I sent a few people to therapy, so that's not that ancient.
Well, between the time that I found out or was told and the time that I actually left the for good, there was no counseling, there was no therapy, there was no their idea of getting me quote-unquote psychiatric help was sending me, you know, shipping me off to the group homes. I didn't start getting therapy again until I was 16. And that was when I entered the foster care system again.
Wow. Now you say again.
Yeah.
Explain again, because my understanding is that you were still in foster care even though you were in the group home.
Now, this is what I didn't put in my little story there. At the age of 10, when I'm in my second group home, I meet my adopted parents. And, you know, they talk to the group home because apparently my behavior is so bad that they're talking, you know, about sending me to a juvenile detention center. But I, keep in mind, never been in trouble with the law. Yeah, but at any rate, I ended up getting adopted at the age of 10, and things didn't quite work out right. Me and my adopted mother, we had some issues, and a lot of them were on her side, and my issues were I had to defend myself. So at the age of 13, I'm placed back into a group home. This is my third and final group home. And at the age of 16, my adopted parents took me to court and unadopted me.
Whoa.
So at the age of 16, I'm placed back into foster care to, finish out my childhood, so to speak. And, yeah, my life has been a bed of roses. But, not to take away from anybody else. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. But not to take away from anybody else. You know, we've all got our horrible horror stories. Mine is what it is. I've made a lot of poor decisions from the time I was 16 up until I met my wife. One of those poor decisions was I dropped out of school. That effect has unfortunately trickled down all the way down to my children. You know, and we all hear, it's your decision, but you're going to have to suffer the consequence. But we don't really, you know, at least I didn't really put much thought into, well, what consequence? What are the consequences? The consequences for me dropping out of school was I didn't get that, you know, high dollar job that I wanted so that I could get that high dollar house so that I could provide for my family. Okay. Instead, I ended up working manual labor jobs, living hand to mouth, and I cannot afford to, you know, spoil my kids with the latest gadgets like I would really love to do. Up until
now,
just recently,
on education, when you were with the families and when you were in the group home, how much much emphasis was placed on education?
Um, when I was with my foster family in Del Mar, education was priority number one. And when I started messing up in school, they kept telling me that, you know, I needed to buckle down. One of their metaphors or sayings was straighten up and fly right.
Did you know that was a song? Did you know that that was a song? That was the title of a song?
No, actually, I didn't.
I'll send it to you.
Okay, great. So at any rate, and Dad never finished school. You know, he had an eighth grade education, but he could do math in his head quicker than we could punch it out on a calculator.
Wow.
I don't know how he did it, but he was, you know, I guess he was just really, really good with numbers. And, you know, I don't think there was ever a time where you could slow him down or stump him. But, yeah, education, especially from Dad's point of view, was very important. He knew that without it, you weren't going to be able to do too much.
At the time, looking at it in hindsight, and one of my goals of this program is how to get people to be more effective in what they do with youth now and how to reach. Because as a child, you heard straighten up and fly right. You heard that education was important, but you knew that your foster father didn't have an education, and you seem to have admired his ability. Is that true?
I admire him very much. He is the definition of a man. I wouldn't doubt it one bit if you looked in Webster's Dictionary and looked up the definition man, and there's his picture.
Mm.
He loved his family. His family was very important to him. You could have, as a matter of fact, I watched him and one of his sons, biological sons, had a squabble. Most fathers and sons do. You know, and they didn't talk for a little bit. But when it came time and his son was in dire need, not once did that squabble come up. It was, you know, my son needs me and I need my dad. So the squabble ended up going away. And, you know, family was very important. Education was very important. I can't say enough about the man. I really can't. I loved him. I really did love him.
Okay. So you said that you did decide that you didn't want to continue school when you were in high school, but this is after leaving that family, after leaving the group homes, after being unadopted. At that point, what was going on with you? What was going on in your head about school? About life?
School was not such a nice place for me. As I'm sure, again, I'm assuming too much, but as I am sure, most foster kids, you know, we get picked on in school. Man, do we get picked on, especially if, you know, somebody finds out that, you know, we're living with a family and we weren't there, you know, yesterday. You know, kids can be cruel, and it just seems to have gotten worse over the years as far as, you know, the cruelness. I got tired of being picked on, and I just figured, you know, God doesn't love me. You know, nobody wants me. And, you know, I certainly don't have a family to go home. I'm living in a group home with five other boys, and, you know, they could seem to really care less. I'm sure I had somebody to talk to, but I didn't know that. I'm 16 years old. I think I know everything and didn't really know squat. So needless to say, I just decided one day, that's it, I'm done. And, that's one of the things I wish I could jump in a time machine and go back and change.
But that's where you were. And it sounds like to me that the academics may not have been as much of a challenge as the social support, or the lack of social support, the lack of feeling that you fit in. that was seemed like that was the biggest issue for you. Is that true?
I don't think it was just the lack of. I think it was the lack of my knowledge and, you know, the fact that I think it was there. I didn't utilize it because
okay.
I didn't recognize it as being there.
Ooh,
like
okay.
I said, I know I had, you know, looking back now, I'm sure that there is somebody that, you know, would have listened, would have offered the best advice. As a matter of fact, I know of one person who did try to offer the best advice, and that was my second social worker. And she, her and I are still in contact. And
cool.
she told me just recently how proud of me she was for the changes that I've made and the person that I have become. And, you know, that there's a lot more gray hair on her now with my name on it, but she's still happy.
Okay. That's funny because I'm saying, okay, she's the good social worker. We call her the good witch.
She stood all
wow.
of the 3 foot.
And thank God for someone like that that you can really look back at. And I think there's one of the things that you're saying to me that I would say to the adults in the village, regardless of whether a young person takes your advice then or not, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't still give it and try to be there. Even if you can't take it all in at the time, at least you can look back now and say, someone was there, I just couldn't recognize it at the time.
Well, you're right. I couldn't recognize it. I didn't want to recognize it. And I, you know, certainly wasn't accepting. So, but yes, most definitely, just because, you know, you have a child in your home or, you know, a child that in some way, shape, or form is in your life, you know, if you feel the need and if you feel the urge, and it's, you know, how do most people put it nowadays, if it's on your heart to say something,
mm-hmm.
then by all means, say something.
Yes, yes. And something that I say often is that you don't expect immediate gratification. And I think when we know that we're sowing into lives and we're giving, you give it for the sake of it being just had, that you've given it, and not expecting something immediately. And I think a lot of adults give up too quickly. And they keep saying, you know, well, I tried. And I think it's an ongoing sowing. It's like when you plant trees, you don't expect to wake up the next morning and have a redwood tree or an oak tree or whatever it is that you've sown. It takes time, you know, and I think of, you know, the Bible says, you know, send some to plant, some to sow, some to water, and, you know, and then some to harvest. So that's part of that process. I see Miss Nikki says, I'm on the phone, what do I do? I see what you just did. So I'll remember to look at that screen. And I think you're supposed to raise your hand, too. And if I cut you off, just come back on because I'm multitasking, trying to write, talk, and listen and see all at the same time. So do you have something to say, Ms. Thompson? She said, I'm not kidding. Wait, let's pause for a minute and let Nikki jump in. But I want to come back and talk about your, you know, when you left school, what was it that changed your position, one, on being open to someone loving you, to being able to hear, and then we're going to talk about your pursuing your education after that point. So if I can find this screen, I'm going to bring Miss Nikki on, and there she is. She does have her hand up. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to call in to, for one, give my support to Stuart. So, hi, Stuart.
Hi.
Can you guys hear me okay? Okay.
We can hear you just fine.
Okay. I just had a question for Stuart. I had actually read a post earlier, Stuart, that you had posted, I think, in one of the forums, how you were adopted. I think you said by age 10 and by age 13, they unadopted you. Now, although I was never adopted, you know, I understand the feeling because I was, you know, kind of rejected twice and sent away twice. And I just wanted to know, how did you go about, you know, having been rejected like that for yet a second time?
All right. Well, if I, first of all, if I made a post like that, then I was definitely typing faster than, or speaking in my mind faster than I was typing. It was at the age of 13 when I left the adopted home and the age of 16 when I got unadopted. Really, it was, I don't think I really ever dealt with that rejection. I think it was just more or less like I expected it. There were things that were happening in the home that I didn't want to go back to. The group home itself, I was one of the first six to open the group home. This group home was built, had nobody in it, and I was one of the first of the six boys that, you know, got to live in the group home. They had a rule that, you know, every Friday night you could go home for the weekend just so long as you were back by Sunday morning or, sometimes Sunday evening. Well, every Friday morning I would get up and I would, you know, cuss out a staff member or, you know, just do something really idiotic to get placed on restrictions so that I couldn't go home.
Okay.
But as far as being rejected, you know, it was, like I said, there was things going on in the home that I absolutely didn't want to go back to. So it wasn't really necessarily a feeling of rejection, rather a feeling of freedom.
A relief, yeah. Now, see, as a therapist, I would think that someone would have said and noticed the pattern and would have said, Stuart, I notice every time it's, you know, you have an opportunity to go home, you make a choice to do something that you can't. Do you really want to go? It seems like you don't really want to go. And you don't have to do this. You don't have to curse somebody out to not go. And could give you the power to say, to empower you to be able to say, no, I don't want to go. And it sounds like no one ever even asked you.
Well, no. The director at the time, the director of the group home, did come to me after the second week of my doing that, and he did tell me. He said, "Look, if you don't want to go home, just say so. You don't have to get put on restriction all the time." I didn't, you know, follow his advice because I figured if I tell them that I don't want to go home, then I would have to give them a reason. Nobody was believing me anyway because I was wearing many labels at this time. Emotionally disturbed, a thief, a liar, a pathological liar. There were many, many labels on my, you know, case file.
Negative.
So, right, very negative, everything negative. So I chose not to listen to him, and I chose to do my own thing because then I knew that, I had that sense of, you know, DTA, don't trust anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's what I did. The only person I trusted was me. I figured if I got on restriction, then I knew I could trust myself not to go home.
Wow.
So.
And assuming that you were saying things were going on in the home, I'm assuming it had something to do with abuse?
Correct.
Okay. Is this something that you feel comfortable in sharing during this time?
I'll share the last incident that happened. This is the incident that got me placed into the foster or the group home. My adopted mother was really anal about things being cleaned out before they're thrown away. Things like the mayonnaise jar, the peanut butter jar, the jelly jar. You know, that you had to make sure that it was completely empty before you threw it away. Needless to say, on this particular day, I apparently did not clean it out to her liking. So she smacked me in the head a couple of times with a wooden cooking spoon, grabbed me by my throat until I blacked out. When I came to, she had me by the hair of my head, asked me what, you know, pardon my language, what the hell I was doing on the floor. And my response was, you know why you be, and I gave her a nice right uppercut.
Mm.
So, and I am not in any way promoting anybody to go hit a woman. I don't like it, and I'm still, after so many years, conflicted over what I did because it's just not something that needs to be done. However,
let me say this. I don't condone kids, you know, being disrespectful to adults. However, acknowledging and understanding your emotions and feelings, what would someone else do? If someone were to knock you out, try to choke the life out of you, and you came to and you had all this pent-up emotion, what would you do? That's all I'm saying is that you're human. And I think that's what we don't give our kids to try to understand what's going on. No, we don't condone that behavior, but two wrongs don't make a right. But it's still, you have your feelings to be validated. So I would say if you are dealing with any guilt behind that, you know, I'll be the fairy godmother, the other Glenda Richardson, let it go. Because you are inclined to have emotions. And see, that's the confusing part. When kids are so tied up with all so much, and it's just become layers and layers and layers and layers of emotion, and then you've got, you know, this negative stigma stereotype attached to you, you're trapped. You are trapped. So I can understand. She unadopted.
Sorry, my kids. And you know, it is still something that I wrestle with today. But I mean, everything you said is you know, that's how, you do have a valid point. Yeah, you know, my rage was going, my emotions were going, and I had to get them out, and I knew she was wrong. No matter how wrong I may have been, I knew she was more wrong, but two wrongs don't make a right, so.
And she was the adult.
But yeah, that
child.
Yeah, but, you know, that's, like I say, to finish answering Nikki's question, that's why I say it was more of a feeling of freedom and, as you said, relief that, you know, I was let go.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we went into the judge's chambers, and when the judge asked, you know, why do you want to let him go, their response was, you know, you know, he's cost us over $10,000. We've put him in therapy, and it just isn't working. Nothing seems to be working, and you know, everything was. It just seems like everything was just about, you know, money and my conforming to their way of life. They had taken, you know, everything from me. I had a little brown suitcase that I carried with me throughout my 10 years. And because it was raggedy and old, they threw it away. She had me sit down and write a letter to my foster mom and told me what to write, which basically ended up saying that my foster parents were no longer my parents. I would no longer be calling them mom and dad, that, you know, I had a new family. You know, all of this stuff. So when it came time, the judge asked me how I felt about it. I just simply told the judge flat out, there's no sense in making them do something they don't want to do. They don't want to be my parents, fine. They don't have to be my parents. I just want my birth name back. So, that's pretty much how it went down that day. But yeah, I've been kind of a free spirit ever since.
Okay. As they say, the blessing within the curse. We have another caller, and then we're going to move on. And I think I know who this person is. Hello, you're on the air. Hello? Okay, somebody doesn't want to talk. Okay, we'll continue going. Or maybe they had us muted. So you went to the, you left the group home. Did you age out of there at 18 or 16?
No, actually, when my unadoption was finalized, that's when they took me out of the group home and put me back in foster care. And I ended up aging out of foster care.
Okay.
So all in all, total combined, I spent 12 years in foster care. And in 12 years, I had been in 21 homes. That's including the three foster home or group homes.
Wow.
Now, I believe you said something about moving on to the education. I used, when I met my wife, my wife and I have something in common. She was also adopted. So we could, connect on that. We took off from there. And she was just as stubborn as I was. And I told her, all about my experiences growing up, the physical and the sexual abuse. And, I made her aware of the fact that I didn't want to become a part of the statistics that say that, abused children grow up to be abusers. She and then told, and that foster children grow up to be criminals and things of that nature. But, she did in turn tell me that, the path that I was choosing to rebel was going to end up landing me in jail anyway. So in a sense, I was part of the statistic. It made me really sit down and think. So after doing that, listening to her and her and I talking and sharing, and I found other ways and started, like one way actually was talking more about my experiences with anybody that would listen. And planting that seed. And we ended up getting married 8 years ago. We've been together for 15 years. She came into the relationship already with a child, and he was 18 months old when we met. He's now 16. And I dare anybody to tell me he's not my son. Her and I together have three children. So all in all, we have four. And it was education reared its ugly head again one day when my oldest son brought home a bad report on his progress report. And we were living in what's commonly called the ghetto, surrounded by drugs, guns, and murder. And I just asked him, I said, do you like the fact that we can't go outside, just because of your safety? Do you like the fact that we have to live here because I can't afford for us to live anywhere else? And, of course, all of his answers were no. So I told him, I said, well, do better than I did. Be better than me and get your education. Well, he flipped the script on me and said, you didn't. That's what put me back in school, and that was in 07. I started school again. By October of 08, I believe, September of 08, I finished the program. The program I was in was the External Diploma Program. And I can't stress this enough, it is not a GED, it is an actual high school diploma. By October of 08, I was in college.
Yeah.
Did my first fall semester, did my first spring semester in 09, and finally received my diploma in June of 09. And I am still currently in college. Just finished another spring semester at Warwick Community College on the eastern shore of Maryland. And because my family and I moved to Virginia, I just transferred everything to Eastern Shore Community College. I believe that's in Oh, crap. I don't want to tell you the city because I might get it wrong, but at any rate, it's in Virginia. but
the point is, it is, and you are. Yes.
But I that's what I tell all my children. I said, the only thing I expect from you guys, there's you know, three things I expect from you guys. First and foremost, you bring me a diploma. I figure if they're going to work hard enough to get that diploma, then they're going to work hard at everything else they do with you know, without even thinking about it. The second and third thing I tell them is, you know, to do better than I did and to be better than me. I don't want you to be like me. I want you to be better than me. And I think as a parent, across the board, I think that's pretty much what we all want. We want our children to be better than us and to do better than us. Because, you know, somewhere down the line, we had a missed opportunity and, you know, it may or it may not hurt us, but we know it was a missed opportunity at any rate. So that and the mistakes that we've already made. But yeah, that's my motto when it comes to my kids. You know, do better than me, be better than me.
But you know, I have another motto which you actually embraced, and it's, I can show you better than I can tell you. You
right.
told them that you did it. And I really believe that children learn by example more than they do by what they hear, what we say. They go more by what they see than what they hear. And you showed him. And so I would add to your motto is, be the best you that you can be so that he can be the best him that he can be. So I would like to add that because I think that's what you've done. And I think you've shared with me what he said when you got your diploma?
Yes, I when he first told me that, though, you know, I had something not so nice go through my mind, but I didn't, you know, I didn't say it. But when I finally got my diploma, I don't know if anybody's familiar with a comedian by the name of Jeff Dunham. He has a puppet named Peanut. And when Peanut, you know, does or says something out of the ordinary or out of the blue that, you know, he shouldn't have said, you know, Peanut will hang his head and go, crap. And when I got my diploma, my son just, you know, he hung his head and said, crap, and then just looked at me and smiled. So, you know, he knew it was game time now, so.
All right. That means you raised the bar on him. That means that you raised the bar on him, that he had nothing, he had no excuses at that time.
Correct. And
yes.
his mother and I are both very proud of him. You know, every chance he gets, he'll tell his teachers that, you know, I'm the reason my dad went back to school, and I have no problem with that. You know, I told him that is something to be proud of. At least you know that you, you know, had an influence and made a difference in, you know, at least my life. So.
And the life of the whole family. What has it done for you, having gone back? How has it impacted you personally?
I gained a sense of self-worth. You know, not only did I prove to him and my wife and our other children that I could do it, but I proved to myself that I could do it too, because we had
you've got some background noise. I'm not sure if that's from you or one of our listeners.
No, it was from me.
Okay.
But we had other adversities coming at us too, you know. My wife fell ill and had to go through chemotherapy while I was just about done with my school. And because family is so important to me, I told my wife that, you know, we need to get you taken care of and I can always go back to school and finish. Her and I don't want to say we argued, but we kind of bickered over it for a few days. I finally made my decision that I was done, and I walked into the school, and I, you know, tears streaming down my face, and I told them, my wife is really sick. I need to be at home with my family. I'm going to have to quit. One of the ladies stood up and said, you know what? I'm not going to let you quit. Where do you live? I'll come to your house once a week. And that's what she did until I finished the program. So,
wow.
It renewed my faith, I guess you could say, in my fellow man. And, you know, the fact that, you know, if you are honest with people, you know, then people would be more willing to help you rather than giving them your, you know, woe is me, sob story. You know, this is the kind of life I had. I don't expect anything else from it, and all that other, you know, nonsense that you can throw out there just to get, you know, pity.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. I used my wife a lot of times. I used that as an excuse for things I did, as a way to get out of, you know, trouble. Only to find out now in my late 30s that, you know, if I had just been honest with people from the start and honest with myself, most importantly, things would have turned out a lot better a lot sooner.
Mm.
But no need in crying over spilled milk. I've wiped it up. I've gotten rid of the bad milk smell. So my confidence is higher.
You got a little out of it. A little butter.
Yeah. I even got a little butter because I'm circling on a roll.
Mm-hmm. It took me a minute. I got that one almost the second part of that. I love it. And I'm sure your sense of humor has definitely played a and you're being able to come through all the challenges that you've come through. And that there's a proverb that states, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And that was not only an analogy for you, that was literal. But you were a student who was ready, and a teacher, an extraordinary teacher, appeared to walk you through the very parts that you needed to complete, even when you were facing obstacles. So I just, that's really touching to me. That is very, very touching. There was another question I was going to ask, and it's about time for our call to end, but I always have now decided to start adding a little time to the amount of recording time that we have because we almost always go over, so I don't like to feel rushed towards the end. But I was going to ask you, when you dropped out of school, you were still in the foster care system, right?
Correct.
How is it that you were allowed not to go to school when you were a dependent of the court and they were responsible for your growth and development?
I had to get a job.
Okay. So they allowed to quit school.
They allowed me to. I'm sorry. I keep cutting you off. There's like a delay. I am so sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, we got a little out of sync, and I think it's probably a combination of the phones as well as the actual program line. But I was saying that you said you had to get a job. So I'm saying they allowed you to not go to school, but to get a work permit, because at 16 you need a work permit and to work a full-time job. So is that what happened?
Yes, it was actually a part-time job because of the fact that I was under 18. So I could not work but a certain amount of hours.
Mm-hmm.
As long as I had a job, then I could stay within the system. It was, their requirements were school or a job until I reached 18. And once I reached 18, depending on the situation, again, if you're in school and you reach 18 and you're in foster care, you graduate high school, if you're going to go into college, then they'll keep you in foster care until you're 21. But if, you know, unfortunately, you're not in school at 18, then they've actually implemented some programs since then, but back in the day it was at age 18, you graduate, you're done, you're on your own. But again, back in my day, it was either school or job, and if you had a job by the time you were 18, you've had that job long enough where you should have saved up some money, and now you're on your own with your own little, you know, nest egg. But at 16, I didn't have anybody trying that I know of or that I can recall trying to teach me the quote-unquote value of a dollar. So as soon as I got my paycheck, the same day I got my paycheck, I was broke.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and did they? Because they probably didn't have independent living skills programs at that time, did they?
No, I don't think so. I just remember, you know, like I say, living off of other people's families.
Wow! Wow!
And yes, my sense of humor did get me through a lot. I found out, I actually had somebody sit down and tell me, I believe it was a teacher or maybe even a guidance counselor. I'm in the office. And when I was a kid, I mean, don't get me wrong, I sound like I'm a, you know, pretty decent stand-up man. But when I was a kid, man, I was a crybaby. The least little thing, I cry. So I'm in the office, and I'm bawling my eyes out. And, you know, this kid's picking on me for this reason, and this kid's picking on me for that reason. And they just looked at me and said, you know, you're a nice young man. Why don't you try and find some humor in your situation so that when they pick on you, you have something funny to say back, and therefore it doesn't hurt quite as bad. Not that it doesn't hurt, but that it doesn't hurt quite as bad. So took a lot of hard work, but, you know, I managed to, I guess you could say, perfect it in my own little way to where now I can just, you know, make a joke about my own life and it no longer stings.
Yeah, as much, and as I stated to you before, that's just one of the defenses that can be used, but as with all defenses, my concern is that they're not overused, because at some point we have to be able to speak openly and honestly about what's really going on rather than deflect from it. But, of course, not every space is the appropriate place to do that. So I'm so glad to have had you here on our program, and I'm actually sure you're going to be back, because you brought up a lot of issues that we're going to actually be focusing on. And one of those is the disrupted adoptions. The other is reporting abuse and trying to empower, because there's a lot of allegations, but at the same time, people tend to undermine what's going on with the child. You mentioned the physical abuse, the sexual abuse. You talked about, you know, just the whole thing of not knowing who you were. So that's a lot of topics wrapped up in one. And you stated that when you volunteered to be on the program, you stated you are now ready to do what?
Come out of hiding.
Come out of hiding. And so
I am out. The reason I say come out of hiding is because, you know, foster children have an uncomfortable stigma about them. And a lot of people, you know, adults even, look at us, you know, like, I wonder what's wrong with him. I wonder why his family didn't. And, you know, what they fail to realize is that the unfortunate part of it is that there are a lot of foster kids, and there really shouldn't be. But because there are a lot of foster kids, we're taking over your neighborhoods. One of us could be dating your daughter. You don't know. And I'm in a neighborhood where there is no foster children. And I'm ready to come out.
Are you sure?
Yes, I am sure.
Okay.
I am 100% absolutely sure that I'm surrounded by a bunch of old geezers and farmers.
That doesn't mean might not be children. They could have been. They could be former foster children.
I'm out in the sticks, man. I'm becoming a country hick.
I'm going to challenge you, and maybe 6 months I'm going to give you an assignment to check out some of your neighbors, because you're everywhere. You never know, but that's just an assumption. But go ahead. I cut you off. Continue.
No, you're fine. You're fine. I was just going to say that foster children are everywhere, and a lot of us are in hiding. We don't want people to know that we're foster kids because of the simple fact that, you know, we get looked at differently. And I say we because I still consider myself a foster kid. My mother and father, according to my birth certificate, is the state of Maryland. So I guess by all rights, I'm an orphan. I'm tired of hiding, and I figure if I can come out and show them how courageous and how brave that I can be, that, no matter how old they are, they should be able to stand up, be proud of who they are. And this goes for foster parents, too. Foster parents need to be proud of who they are as well. I'm not saying, wear a sign, I'm a foster parent or I'm a foster kid. But, don't hide who you are or what you do in a shameful cloud. There's nothing to be ashamed of. It's not our fault. We need to accept that it's not our fault. Be proud of us because somebody loves you. Somebody somewhere loves you.
And wants to love you. When they find you, you have to come out to be found.
Right. Just like I did with my wife, bless her heart. She puts up with a lot of my BS, a lot of my corny jokes, a lot of my stubbornness. But she loves me through it all, and I heard a comedian say this one time, so I'm going to steal this from him, and I can't give him the proper credit because I don't remember his name, but a comedian said one time, my wife is the type of woman that if I do good, she kisses me on the forehead, and if I do bad, she smacks me in the back of the head. That's metaphorically speaking, of course, but that's my wife.
That's beautiful, and that's what we need, someone to just be there. Regardless, just to be there regardless, and it would be honest with us, and that's called unconditional love. And you said something about pride, and I want to say that, with this being National Foster Care Month, one of my things, I call ours foster pride, and one of my goals is to reinforce, to give a sense to foster a sense of pride in our foster youth rather than to add shame and embarrassment. And I have a situation where I think during our very first event that we had regarding foster care, one of the young ladies that I was working with was there, and one of her classmates was there. And it was the first time that they knew that each other were foster kids, because they had been embarrassed to say so to one another. And she said after that, they became even better friends because they understood one another and they didn't have to hide certain things in their lives. And that has been the impetus for me to continue the work that I do, because I don't want any child to walk around feeling ashamed, especially over something that they had nothing to do with. And so our goal is to implement a sense of foster pride. And I just want to say today, I believe in doing this. That's exactly what you've done. And I am excited to be the one that you've started with. And I hope that I can be able to support you in doing that, and that we can work together to touch lives all over the world. So I just want to say thank you so much for being our guest this evening. We have lots of comments. Oh, we have lots of comments in the chat room. There's what it says. I love our little family, and somebody's getting a kiss and turning up upside down. And they said, you're great. They're going to give you an ice cream cone tonight instead of a cone.
That must have been Kathy.
So thank you, everyone, for listening. And probably in about an hour, this call will be archived, and you can come back and listen to it over and over again. It will also be posted on our website at www.forachildsheart.org under radio show. You can also go there to take a look at our television interviews as well. So hopefully we're going to be in the same area at some point so we can meet face-to-face. And I just want to thank you so much for volunteering, and I feel like the time couldn't have been more perfect. For anyone else listening, we're always open to having you share your stories here and to encourage, motivate, and bring healing to others as well as ourselves. So this is Ms. E saying, do something special for a child's heart, and good night, everyone.
Rachel's weeping.